You're listening to the Sports Therapy Association podcast. Let's talk about.
Welcome to episode 37 of the Sports Therapy Association podcast. And where are we? The 9th of February already this year. Incredible. And what a year, boy. Thanks for joining us. If you are listening to the podcast, then thank you very much. Obviously, you're listening to the recording in that case. If you could do us the favor, if you do enjoy the content, of leaving a review and a rating, that'd be great, because it confuses me. And I don't want to start off, you know, whining, but if we get like 1,000 downloads or something and we got 6 reviews, well, math was never my big thing, but that kind of makes me think, what does that mean? 994 people didn't like it? Or does it mean 994 people don't have access maybe, or have got some issue with leaving a review? I don't know. But I would like to see a few more reviews and ratings on Apple, please. There's so much out there which people can listen to, for good and for bad. But that means that in order to appear on Google, you need people who do enjoy you and support you to leave a rating. That's the only way you rise in the lists and you kind of like appear more in search results. So please, people, from my heart, after this, if you enjoy the content, then go and leave a review and a rating on Apple Podcasts, which is easy on an iPhone. You just click your button, your app, and you're in there. Anyway, that done. So, excited tonight. We're going to start a new, it won't be every week, but we're going to start a regular kind of section, as in Ask the Expert. Definitely asking the professional from a different discipline. I'm going to choose disciplines who we either are working with or we should be working with, and invite you guys to ask questions about anything you want, as long as it's to do with the field of practice that the person we see is coming up with. So tonight, I'm very happy that this guy said yes. Well, put it this way, I needed some podiatry. I went to this guy. That's how good he is. That's how much I believe in him and his team. It's Nick Knight of NK Active. I'm very excited to bring him up. Obviously, I'm biased because I love everything he does and his team, and he's spoken at the Run Chat Live conference this year. He's been a guest on Run Chat Live conference podcast before. So yeah, obviously everything that comes out of his mouth, I'm going to be agreeing with up to a certain point, I imagine. But I want you guys in the room to be asking questions, and definitely the podcast. If you're listening on the podcast as well, then fire in some questions. Find us on Facebook or send me some emails, matt@runchatlive.com or matt@thesta.co.uk, and we'll get some back to you. Or if you're watching on YouTube, leave something in the comments section. It's getting a bit more active now, the YouTube, so feel free to write comments in there. We will get back to you, I promise you. So before I bring Nick up, as always, I just want to say thank you to last week's guest. Last week, we were honored to have the exceptional Dr. Tim Gabbett on the show. It was a great episode, and I appreciate, again, all the emails we've had thanking Dr. Tim Gabbett for coming in. It was all about training load and injury management, but it was the person delivering it more than anything. A wealth of experience, so highly respected. It really was an honor to have him. And don't forget also that if you are a member of the STA, then there is a code available. I'm not going to say it in here because it's only for members of the STA, where you can get a discount on Tim's Train Smarter and Harder courses, the online courses on there. Hugely recommended. There was a few people in the show last week who have done them, who have been involved, and they're exceptional. They really are another one of these courses that bridges the gap between just relying on your hands and manual therapy and then really getting your head around loading, whether it's for rehabilitation or performance or both. So if you haven't seen that discount yet, then check on their members only page or contact us. Definitely worth considering if you're looking for online CPD. So tonight, Ask the Podiatrist, starting off this new section. Get some questions ready, people. Obviously, if you're listening, you won't be able to ask questions if you listen to the podcast. But if you do join us live, then what happens is I can bring up your questions on the screen and your Facebook profile appears. It's a great way of getting yourself seen and networking. So maybe next time, come and join us for one of these. But for now, I shall bring in Nick Knight coming up. Hi, Nick.
How are we doing? Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, no, thanks for saying yes.
I feel very pressured to follow Tim. It's sort of like...
Well, who wouldn't?
No.
I mean, who wouldn't?
Yeah, exactly. I'm a big fan of his work, personally.
But again, he's so modest, which is what I love, as you are. As most people I seem to choose, the first criteria seems to be subconsciously got to be a modest guy. Brilliant. Do you follow, I mean, following on Instagram as well, what a workout as well. I mean, it's like one of these Instagram things which just incite you and give you inspiration to go work out, because he's no spring chicken, to be the first to say. But boy, does he push himself. You know,
he does.
He actually does the rep ranges which the studies recommend, as opposed to us who just say people do four reps and then never do ourselves. He really is the real McCoy and in great shape. So definitely follow Tim Gabbett if you don't on Instagram, if you need some middle-aged inspiration. Total warrior. But anyway, this is all about you tonight, not Tim. what would you normally be doing tonight at 8:08 if I hadn't dragged you on here?
8:08 on a Tuesday, I'd mostly be on Peloton.
Really? Okay.
So I managed to, we're refurbing part of the clinic and I had to go pick something up. So I finished work early. So I managed to get a Peloton session in before picking the children up from nursery. And I'm just crossing my fingers that they don't wake up halfway through this because my wife's still at work. normally they don't. But when you're doing anything live, you're like, okay, anything could happen.
Exactly. So, it was a leading question. Yeah, the kids situation, that's what we've got. I just like to share the panic of kids waking up, especially when you're by yourself. What are you going to do if someone starts crying?
Depends how loud they cry.
They'll get your earphones in, so we won't say.
Yeah.
Right, so just welcoming a few people who've come in. Danny Mathis has joined us. How are you doing? Nick can also see your comments in the side. So, Nick, if you see any questions there whilst I'm warbling on that you like the look of and you'd like to address, then just... you know, cut in and say, oh, that was an interesting question there from Catherine or something. So thanks for joining us, people. Like I say, this is all about these sessions, especially all about you just firing questions to Nick. I'd love to use this opportunity to maybe clear up some misconceptions about what podiatrists do, to clear up some of your fears, to clear up what maybe you could be doing to bridge the gap when you don't need to send somebody to podiatrists, because Nick is not going to try and get all the work from himself. He's very busy man. He's got a great active clinic. So really is one of the good guys here tonight. So do feel free to ask questions. Obviously, we're not just going to work in the current scenario where we're not allowed to practice. We're not allowed to do close contact services. We'll imagine we're looking also when we can get back to work and see people. So we'll pretend. And then hopefully in the not too distant future, we'll look at that as a scenario. So whilst you guys are thinking of questions, I think I will start off, and then as soon as you guys start, I'll just shut up. But first thing for you, Nick, I would like to ask, as a health professional who is allowed to see everyone they want, one of the lucky allied health professionals, are you still doing any form of screening? Are you kind of obliged to send people away if in theory they don't need to see, or what's the score there?
So legally, we're not obliged to. We don't have to, but I still think there is that even though legally I'm allowed to see anyone I want, I still think you have a moral and ethical duty to make sure you're seeing the right people. So all our patients, they go through a screening process anyway, and that involves like pre-assessment questionnaires, and we get a few patients that actually just self-select to go to virtual. And then on that, we then decide actually whether they need to come into clinic, because if you get a patient who their injury may be related that during lockdown, prior to lockdown, I don't know, they played squash 3-4 times a week. And then during lockdown, they decided they wanted to become a runner and haven't run before in their life, apart from running around a squash court, but decide to run 10K 3 times a week and then get an injury. You most probably don't really need to see that person to tell them what they've done, what's gone wrong and why. And obviously that will then link back nicely to your guest last week. So things like that. But then you get some patients where actually they have been struggling a lot, and you get some people that don't fit well with that online virtual consultation. So we're encouraged basically to use our own clinical judgment on what is right, what is wrong. But then in clinic, we sort of, my clinic's in the middle of the countryside, so we get no through traffic, as it were. It's sort of one in, one out policy with gaps in the middle, and everyone sort of says they feel safe coming in. So we screen, but then we also let the patient decide what they want. if they decide they want to come in, a lot of the time we may turn and say, actually, we can follow this up virtually. You don't need to keep coming in. So that's the way we're sort of doing it, as it were.
I guess the advantage you've got, and I noticed it before, it might have been pre-COVID, but definitely at the beginning of the first COVID lockdown, was you've got a great setup for virtual consultation as well. Was it before? Were you already in the process of putting that together? Or
yeah, we started doing virtual consultations most probably about 18 months ago. And then when we had to close the clinic in, well, I say we had to close the clinic in March, we were told to close the clinic, but actually it's now just come to light that legally we didn't have to close the clinic, but we told were, but that's a whole different story. We won't go there. I ended up doing like 100 consultations virtually in 2 months, just because people, the one good thing COVID has shown is you can do a lot more remotely than we thought we could do originally, because it basically forced our hand to do it. And it has opened the scope of seeing patients from outside the UK, different places. We've had people who want to travel from us all over the UK, where we say actually that we can just manage this virtually. And then if you still don't feel comfortable doing it virtually, we can get you to come in at the right time. I think there are some positives to be taken from it as well.
We've had a few episodes now and about virtual consultations from the beginning, because I mean, this whole, even though we're at 37 now, this whole Sports Therapy Association podcast was basically born out of COVID, in the sense that a lot of sports therapists and soft tissue therapists needed some information. They were looking around, they were desperate. It was all mixed messages. So it came out of that. But in the process, yeah, there's been a lot of fantastic episodes about virtual consultations, and also the message that you can still work as a sports therapist, even though you are not allowed to do close contact services. And we were talking about the other week that it seems that a lot of people who are shouting out the loudest about, we should be open, why is it physios and podiatrists and chiros allowed to be working and we can't, and getting really irate about it and not really getting anywhere, are not either confident or happy or aware of how to use virtual consultation. And then I think if we did a proper kind of analysis or study, the more you believe that these are doing the magic, the less confident you are at doing a virtual consultation, because you're purely thinking, well, if I can't touch them, I can't do anything.
1,000%. And the beauty of what virtual consultation does, it makes you up your game and your history taking. Now, I'm a big believer that the reason all our patients get a 4-page questionnaire before we see them, and if they fill it in correctly, I could mostly diagnose their problem before I even see them virtually or in clinic. History is so, so important. And I just use, so if you come see me for an initial consultation, it's 45 minutes. 35 of that is me speaking and just listening. The rest of it, I may do some hands-on stuff, but it's sort of just to sort of confirm my thoughts and processes. But the majority of it is just, and of that, I would say it's most probably 5 minutes of me speaking, 25 minutes of me just listening. The way I look at our jobs is we're a detective, and the crime scene is the patient, and they hold all the answers. And if you ask them the right questions, they'll give you the answers. And you just got to unlock them bit by bit. Because when you first see a patient and they're a new patient, there isn't that trust relationship. So they may hold information back. And then as you build that rapport, they then start leaking stuff out and just telling you more and more. And you sort of then, the art of active listening is 90% of what they say may not be relevant, but 10% may be golden. And it's just picking up what that 10% is. But
that was just excellent. Comes. Is that yours? We're the detective and the injury is the crime scene.
I think so.
Patent it quick. You know, Mike James will have that on a meme tomorrow. It'll just be, that'll be his next week of advertising.
I think so. I haven't heard anywhere. So if someone has said it, I apologize because I've forgotten who you were. But to my knowledge, I haven't heard anyone else say
it. I have yet to see it yet. Okay, I'm putting that down. So I'm going to put it now. Nick Knight has said that. We're the detective. The injury is the crime scene. We've got to investigate. It's beautiful. Right, you heard it here first. I have to put this comment up here because, look at this for testimonial. Look at that. Hello, legends. It's only Gemma Oliver.
Yeah, from a legend. Hi, Gemma. I call her a legend, but I won't call myself a legend.
I know. So. Well, Gemma said it now. And Gemma doesn't speak, the lie. So, I mean, that's it. That's fact now. We are legends. Just means you're old when people call you a legend. But anyway, thanks, Gemma. Good to see you here. Right, we've got some questions coming in. So... guess what? It's about insoles. Here we go. I want to make sure we do talk that podiatrists don't just give orthotic devices out, but we'll get into that. But the first question is here. So I'm going to read it out for people listening to the podcast as well. So a question here from Emma Victoria Wardle says, hi, Nick. Should you be wearing insoles long term? I was told I needed to be wearing mine at the start all the time and in all shoes at age 10, 11, and that I would struggle with high impact exercise without them, e.g. running. And I'm a squash player. Also, oh, it scrolled up a bit. Also, how often should you get a review of your orthotics? Good question, Emma.
So that's a great question, and it is a question I get on a weekly basis. Let's go, so even daily basis. For me, there is this massive misconception that orthoses are, or insoles, orthoses is the proper term, are a life sentence. And in the majority of our patients I see, that's not the case. For me, if you're a runner and you're only getting pain on running, but you don't get pain doing anything else, I don't really see the need to have to wear the orthoses for doing the other activities because they don't hurt. One way you can look at orthoses is that they're a tool to help offload a structure whilst you're doing a certain activity. Now, don't get me wrong, there are certain pathologies where, say, hypermobility, where your tissue tolerance may be a lot lower, so you may need orthoses longer term, because no matter how strong you make yourself, you're still increasing that risk of overloading. Or you may have something like arthritis where your body's capacity to tolerate load is reduced. But I don't think in about 80% of orthoses that I prescribe, the aim is to remove them eventually. How often should they be reviewed? For my custom fit orthoses, I'll send a message to the patient 6, 12 and 18 months later just to see how they're getting on. But if they've got no symptoms, I won't routinely review orthoses just for the sake of reviewing them, because I tend to adopt the analogy, if it's not broke, don't fix it. So we'll keep in contact, but I won't bring someone in for review just for the sake of review, because if they're not getting any symptoms, I just think that's just a waste of their money, because we're purely a private clinic. I'm not in the game of just bringing someone in for an appointment for the sake of it if they're not getting any problems. And I think that covered it. Yeah, so for me also, when I'm issuing orthoses, I always issue some strengthening exercises at the same time. It's never orthoses just in isolation. And orthoses could be part of the rehab process. They could be as part of that to offload a tissue whilst you're going through that rehab journey. Then once you've got capacity, you can then look at removing those orthoses, then try, see what happens. If symptoms flare up and your strength improves, that may be an indicator that you do need orthoses longer term. But then it may be an indicator that actually your pain doesn't return and you keep up with those exercises. The reason I like giving the strengthening exercises, I think along with the orthoses, I think there is a risk that if you give someone a set of orthoses and it relieves the symptoms, people then may not then do the exercises attached to that. And as you know me well, I'm very focused on the, as a podiatrist, I'm really focused on the rehab side of things. And also, it's a bit of a long-winded answer, but hopefully that answers the question.
Everything in there couldn't have taken one word out. It's interesting that, and I wonder whether this is the fault of the podiatrist or whether the patient just wasn't listening or they've just forgotten over the years, but it's always amazing how many patients we see or clients who arrive with some kind of orthotic device and they've been wearing it for maybe 5-10 years or sometimes even longer, and they've got no idea why they were given it in the first place, and they weren't told how long they were supposed to have it for. It's like they were never given that information, and 10 years has gone by. It's quite a new thing, isn't it? I mean, is this something which all podiatrists are on board now, this whole idea of dosing, or is it relatively new?
I think it's relatively new. I don't think all podiatrists are on board with it. The way I'm not a bit of a rebel, but I always ask why. Like if someone's been done something for years, I'll ask why, and if you can't give me a valid answer as to why, I'll go and change it and do my own thing if I think it's better. But the thing we always do in if I come up with a new idea or a new way of doing things, we'll test it in clinic, but then we'll audit our own data to see, does it work, yes or no? And if it doesn't, we just adapt and change. But I'm not scared of asking why, and if someone can't give me a valid answer, just coming up with new ideas, because the only guarantee and constant in life is change, isn't it? So we've all got to change and adapt and evolve as we go on. So, and I think we need to change our mindset around orthoses as well, if I'm honest.
Very good. I like this. I should be writing this down myself. Very good. Great question, Emma. Great one to kick things off. And do come back with a follow-up if you like. I think there's probably people are going to stay on this subject for a while now. Let's just go down the Sue Richards is applauding your analogy. That was the crime scene, wasn't it? Yeah. I know. So did you hear the one about the only thing guaranteed is change? I'm still reveling in that one. Beautiful.
That's a Greek quote, I think. I've forgotten, was it? I can't remember. Is it Hippocrates? I can't remember. The only thing constant in life and change is an old Greek mythology quote somewhere.
Yeah, but you've brought it up there. I mean, fine. You're standing on the shoulders of giants, but you're still standing and waving, so it's fine. So Gemma has just commented, Nick, subjective detective. Oh, lovely. Even rhymes. Subjective detective is the way forward in face-to-face and virtual. How many of us actually listen to our patients? Really listen.
And if we look at all my feedback, that is the one biggest thing people say to us is you're the first person, the first team just to sit and just listen. That is the one biggest thing that we get from our patients.
It's very good. There's definitely gold here for any form of healthcare professional, which is something else which we've talked about in previous episodes, how as we all evolve, regardless of the profession, what we do and the methods we use become more similar, which is one of the beautiful things. Let me go down. There's more fist clenching and bumping from Gemma in agreement. And let's have a look down. John Gibbons is in the house as well. How are you doing, John? I have said it. Therapy detectives is mentioned in my books. Yeah, but John, you're only about 22 years old, aren't you? Nick's older than you, so it must have been. Tina, here we go. Interest in this also. Let's bring this up. Tina from Equity Health and Wellbeing, reading out for the podcast listeners. Interest in this also. My daughter, now 13, has had them for 4 years and don't feel I'm getting anywhere with national health systems. Her feet and ankles are a mess. A little bit of catastrophic language going on there, but we'll talk about that. I know I need to go private, but need to get it right. What's up, Tina? They told you what's creating this mess. What is going on? But yeah, with children, is there a difference when we're working with children?
Yes. It's with children, you've got to make sure you rule out anything systemic. So if I find a child that comes in who has presentations of a tendinopathy, I'm thinking, okay, I want to rule out other inflammatory problems first, because in general, you don't see children getting. The beauty of being a child is that your tissues are so elastic, you can do pretty much what you want to them. And you get, if you think about it, when I was 13, 14, I was able to sit there and do my paper round, play hockey before school, then run around at lunchtime, then play football, then play hockey again. If I should do that now, I'd be an absolute bitch. I think with the question I've got is why are the orthoses being prescribed, Tina, in that instance? And there are still some beliefs out there that if the foot looks flat in your child, you need to wear orthoses, which is, we know that's not true. Unfortunately, NHS podiatry services are massively sort of stretched, as it were, and they can't all offer the service that the level is needed. So we are finding more people are venturing out into the private therapy world because they can't get to there. So yeah, they're the questions that I would be looking at first, because it may be that the orthoses are needed, but it may be actually we don't need them. I still see patients who are told that they needed orthoses when they were younger to make them grow an arch, but we know that's not going to really change things. But it's also then trying to find a podiatrist that has sort of a special interest in pediatrics. I will see a few, but it's sort of 13 and upwards is where I tend to start. Anything younger than that, I've got other colleagues who see a lot more peds than I do. So you're more than welcome if you want to pop me a private message and I can try and let you know of someone I would recommend in your local area.
Very kind. Tina, there you go. There's an offer for you. But if you do want to continue the questions and you've been told why, then I'd love to hear And we can continue that in a sec. Why? What reason have they given that your daughter's had this for 4 years, and what are they trying to achieve with it? It'd be really cool to hear if you know that information. If you don't know it, then that's the problem, that they haven't told you. But right, let's have a little look. Keep these questions coming, people. We're on a roll now. Chris Kitson's in the house. Hi, Chris. How you doing? Gary is in tears. I'm not sure why, out of laughter. I don't know what that was for, Gary Benson. Let's have a look. Gemma Oliver says, let's have a look what Gemma says. Had an interesting triage virtual the other day. Large hallux valgus deformity and effective walking pain and compensating. Worse over last 3 months, but been going on for a year plus. She wanted to go and see a podiatrist. Recommended a TNO consultant. What's TNO standing for here? But I was 60-40 orthopod.
Trauma and orthopedics?
Orthopedic consultant. But I was 60-40 orthopod. Interested in your thoughts? Question marks. I referred to podiatrist in the end as she wanted their opinion.
Yeah, bunions are an interesting one. So there's nothing that we can do to reduce that deformity, the shape of the deformity. Bunion splints won't reduce the shape of it. Wearing orthoses won't. Doing any strengthening exercises won't massively have an impact on the deformity. So with those, I always ask the question is the joint painful? Because there are things you can do with footwear, orthoses, taping to try and reduce pain and symptoms, but you can't change the deformity itself. So for those, it's working out what's the main cause of the symptoms, I think. If it's purely deformity related, then it's a straight referral to podiatric surgery or orthopedic, whatever you access to in your area. If it's more pain, then it is trying to offload it if you can to make life more comfortable, but it's managing those expectations that whatever you do conservatively isn't going to change how that foot looks. I think a lot of the bunions that I see is they've come in with the expectation that I can change the shape of their toes, and we can't do that. But I know in, for example, the NHS, sometimes you may not be able to refer directly to orthopedics. You've got to go through the channels. When I used to work in the NHS, we could have a whacking great big bunion. It was clear that we needed a surgical opinion, but they still had to go and try podiatry first before funding was then granted for to go down to orthopedics.
I like the fact that you can say so much based on what Gemma's just said. It's good. I would have gone, well, it depends, but I want to know how old she is. I want to know. I mean, it's interesting you say there's not much you can do, but what about, like, for example, a combination of strengthening and just kind of like the whole neural connection with the abductor muscles and things? Because a lot of the time it's just because that big toe has got a valgus, no? Where it's maybe it's because of ill-fitting shoes or lost the power. Is it minimal what you can do with that, with kind of like strengthening? And
you can change. There is some evidence suggests that you may be able to change the deformity slightly, but obviously don't forget that hallux valgus is the sort of the intermetatarsal angle, so between your second and your first. So that's a bony change to the joint. Strengthening can only possibly reduce that to a certain degree, and if you are, and as the longer it goes on, so if we see hallux valgus in the older population, sometimes then there's osteoarthritis then combining with that as well, and the osteoarthritis may be at the MTPJ or it may be down at the tarsal metatarsal joint there is. And then if you're getting that and the severity of the deformity, if you go see a surgeon, what actually dictates what operation they do is actually the size of that angle, because it depends how much correction is needed. But if I had, say, I had someone in their 20s come to see me with a fairly large bunion, it was genetics, it sort of ran in the family, right. It was painful, and I'm like, you're fit and well. I would be considering, because for them it is having issues of rubbing on footwear and things like, and I can't do anything to change that. And if you've got a 20-year-old female, to say them go wear some really wide DB fitting shoes, it's just not going to happen. I've got to be realistic. Whereas in my opinion, if I send them to the surgeon, they're going for a consultation. They're not signing up for surgery. It's all about them doing their own fact-finding mission and getting all the information they need to then make their own informed decision. Mm-hmm. So I'm very keen in clinic that the patient makes their own. We'll give them all the evidence, all the data, all the information, and then they then reflect and then make their own decision where they want to, what they want to do. If I think they're making a really bad decision, I'll let them know. But quite often in my world, there's a couple of options that could be tried. Some patients really want to try everything conservative first. Some people want to go down the surgical route. And if you're talking about bunions, then I personally haven't got any issues referring those off to surgery quite early. But again, I'm in the luxury of the private healthcare where I can just do that and get them in seeing the orthopedic consultant in a few days' time. But I'm fully aware of the restraints within an NHS setting.
Great. Excellent question, Gemma. If anyone else wants to follow that up with another question? I mean, I always kind of think that if a sports therapist really wants to get to understand the foot a bit more, then start off by learning about what the big toe does. Start off looking at that much more than the arch and just looking whether someone's foot drops or not. There may be a relationship, obviously, between the two, but testing for like hallux rigidus and testing how much movement they got, doing musical toes and stuff. I don't think it's done enough on courses. I think there's so much, even on sports therapy courses, high levels, they go straight to medial arch and classifying the arch and all that sort of stuff. And they don't talk about enough of things about how the big toe is. And it's a shame. Okay, we're not going to stay on hallux valgus for now. Let's continue down because I've seen there's some more questions coming in. Here we go, Verona's off. I get pain in my calf most of the time. I've been to a doctor. They said it wasn't DVT. I used to have plantar fasciitis and it got better. I try foam roller and a ball. Can you recommend anything else? I don't wear orthotics. Thanks, Verona. I'm only joking.
Yeah. So let's make the horrible assumption that we're dealing with a calf strain here. Obviously, not seeing, I can't, or not taking a history, I can't. But if we make, let's make the horrible assumption that it is just a calf strain here. For me, I may get shouted at. I'm not a massive fan of foam rolling. For me, if you're getting injured during calf strains and then you've then had a history of plantar fasciitis in the past, that would be telling me that there's most probably some capacity issue around the calf from a strength perspective, in particular soleus. I've obviously been reading too much of Seth O'Neill's work because I think soleus is the most important muscle in the leg. It takes 8 times body weight on running. It takes far more load than gastrocnemius. But when you then look at rehabs and everything, it's always the muscle that is forgotten about. And every time I see a patient in clinic who's had plantar fasciitis or Achilles or calf issues, I get them to try. We test their capacity for the soleus and the strength is massively down from where I want it to be. So for me, it'd be starting on that. I would, before looking at orthoses, I wouldn't worry about orthoses. If you want to try and help, just go and buy yourself a heel raise, something, or get something that's about 10 mil in height and just stick it in the back of your shoe. But then in the meantime, start working on improving that calf strength would be my first port of call for all if it is a calf strain. We don't have a foam roller in clinic and we don't tend to recommend it much.
I use them a lot too, because, you know, if you're doing an abduction exercise, I use it as a target for the person to reach. They're great for just standing up and using it as like a see if you can touch there. I've got their uses.
But I should tell her, like, we use it seven, we're doing a single leg squat to make sure they can do a single leg squat and not knock it over.
There you go, exactly.
But I don't think it's a foam roller. I think we just use a rolled up Pilates mat instead.
Oh, really? And for bridges, they're good. Put it under your bums, you're actually pushing up a little bit more. They have got these. It's a great question, Verona. And again, I want you to get back to us whether you've done any. Have you had, first of all, a professional? Have you had them recommending any strength training? Has anybody who's assessed you tested for strength deficiencies or differences between the two legs? And then thirdly, if you write this down, do you know whether they targeted the soleus to see whether there's a strength deficiency there, or did they just have you standing up with a straight leg on tiptoe and seeing if there was a strength deficiency there? Because like Nick said, sometimes if all the strength work you do is on a straight leg, you're not necessarily hitting the soleus. So come back to us, Verona. Have you been given any strength work? I want to hear back from you. Right, Emma is here now. Emma says, I had lots of strength exercises too, as I had a bilateral knee pain from playing squash, hypermobile, didn't mention that before, did you? Collapsed arches, transverse arches, no issues until I stopped weighing them 2-3 years ago. Just done a chat on it with the reps in STA. Good stuff. Yeah, the podcast, Scott's doing some lovely work in there. If you haven't heard it all yet, sports therapy members, yeah, the reps are doing some great presentations. I'm still wearing the same insoles, never have reviewed, and they still fit. Have added them back into my trainers for running as I was getting knee pain, and it's better now. Interesting. Thank you. Let's highlight that word hypermobility. How does that fit in with a podiatrist? I know for sports therapists, it kind of changes things.
The first thing, this helps prove my point, is the more you get to know someone, the more information you get.
Exactly.
So hypermobility, we see a lot of hypermobile people, and we see a lot of hypermobile people who don't know they're hypermobile. And if you look at Simon Spooner's work on zone optimum stress or Scott Dye's envelope of function, I think the thing with hypermobility, the way I describe it, is that it's almost like an iceberg effect. If you come into clinic and you've got an injury and they say, I got this pain when I went for this run, but I sort of say, well, this is almost like an iceberg because 80-90% of it has been borrowing away in the background, but you've been blissfully unaware. Because you're so flexible, you've been operating to the limit of your capacity nearly, and it only took running down a curb awkwardly to flare it up. So it wasn't the walking down the curb, it's what's then happened for ages, but you only notice the symptoms when pain starts, because otherwise you're not going to sit and analyze everything because you've got no symptoms. So And they're some of the patients that will require orthoses on a longer-term basis. And Emma's sort of case in point there, where done all the strengthening work, remove the orthoses, pain come back, put the orthoses back in, pain starts to settle. And sometimes we see it in hypermobile patients that you can strengthen as much up as you can, but you still can't get that tissue capacity sort of zone right until you use full orthoses. So that's an example where actually they are going to be benefited long term, and if they still fit and they're still functional. So for me, the criteria, what you said there, is that they fit, they're comfortable, and you put them back in and your symptoms are starting to reduce. So would I go get them reviewed at the moment? No, not really, because they're comfortable, they fit, and they're doing the job you want them to do. So I would only maybe go get them reviewed if they become uncomfortable, they break, or symptoms just don't get to a point where you're happy with them. So
fantastic. Great follow-up, Emma. Thanks very much for that. I'm loving this. This is great. Let's go down. Verona's back. Fantastic. Verona says, I start running or walk, I have to keep stopping after a mile. It stops. Okay, so we've got more symptoms. Let us know whether you've been giving any strength training, Verona.
So the big follow-up and question is, if you go for a run and then you have to stop, does the pain settle within sort of 30 seconds? And if you start again, does the pain start again? So you're sort of thinking sort of increased compartment pressures and biomechanical overload or chronic exertional compartment syndrome, what I'll be thinking.
Fantastic. Okay, let's have a look. Tom Sayers. Hi, Tom. How are you doing? All right. Tom says, hi, Nick. When looking for a podiatrist locally to refer patients to, what should we look out for instead of podiatrist or sharp intake from breath? Nick's thinking, I don't want to slag off anybody else. But this is a great question, Tom. It's on my list, so I'm glad you're asking this. What should we look out for instead of podiatrist? Also, would there be specific information you would want in a referral letter from another professional? Thanks in advance. Great stuff, Tom. Brilliant.
No, that's a cracking question. For me, it's about before I refer, if we sort of reverse the tables, me referring out or someone referring in, before I refer anyone to anyone, I get to know the person I'm referring to. So I know what their strengths are, so for me, when you're looking for a podiatrist is don't just look at the label. Don't look at the title, because as Matt already well knows, I'm not a fan of being precious over titles. If you've got a foot and ankle issue, it can be a sports therapist, a physio, a podiatrist. I don't really care who treats that, as long as the person has got the credibility and the skill set to treat that. It's sort of that title doesn't really matter. So it's more about the person. So for me, it's trying to build the relationships up with your local podiatrist to work out whether they're the right type of person. Because one of the beauties of podiatry is such a vast topic that You can specialise in sports, musculoskeletal therapy. You become a podiatric surgeon, diabetes, paediatrics, rheumatology. There are so many variants of what a podiatrist can do. And that's the issue just with the term podiatry. Physiotherapy, I got it nice because you can become an accredited sports physio and have the different levels to my knowledge. In podiatry, there's none of that in place. So you may refer to someone, you may find a podiatrist online, refer them a musculoskeletal case, but their special interest may be diabetes and wound care, where they're not going to be the right person. So that's why I think getting to know the person. Letters are always nice because you can then, for me, I like getting a referral letter with a complete history and everything on there, because I can then get the history from a clinician's viewpoint and a history from a patient's viewpoint, because patients don't always tell you the truth. Sometimes they'll tell you what they think you want to hear. Whereas if you get a letter from a clinician, you can then often have more facts in there as well. So another thing that we always do is anytime I see a new patient, my letter is my notes. So my letter is extremely detailed. And then that always then goes off to GP, patient, and then whoever referred them back. I'm really big on professionals that are working, multiple people working on the same case, really hot on a, make sure everyone's singing off the same hymn sheet. The last thing the patient wants is professional A saying one thing, professional B saying something else. And before you know it, you've got this poor patient in the middle that's getting confused and going to get nowhere. And it's just not going to be a good outcome for anyone, really.
Great question, Tom. Really, really good. I'm interested actually on that subject. If anybody in here, it's like 40 people are joining now, word must be getting around that Nick's giving some total clinical gold gems here. But if any of you have had some experience with podiatrists, obviously they'll just be anecdotal, but I'm interested to hear whether you have referred to podiatrists and regretted it, or whether you've, how do you find podiatrists? People out there, I'd like to know. Thanks, Tom. Great question. Tina is back with more information about her daughter and the orthoses. She had brain scans and also has dexterity problems. Finally, all was told is down to malformation from vitamin D deficiency. Have been fobbed off frequently. I had to read that carefully. Have been fobbed off frequently, and podiatrist told my daughter it's just how you were made when your mum was pregnant.
Yeah, there's some language in there that I'm not too fond of that fellow healthcare professionals have used. I think let us know where you are. I think it's definitely worth getting a second opinion on some of that, and getting someone who has quite a bit of knowledge in podo pediatrics, and getting your daughter to have a check with someone, because especially in the language you use in adults is really important, but it's even more important than in children. My three, I've got to be careful, because when children, their brains are just sponges, and they can, like, you've got to be careful with the language that you use. And the last thing you want to do is be sort of installing fear into a child, because I don't think that's healthy. Yes. So let us know where you're based, and I'll do some digging around. I'm a member of, there is a podo pediatric special interest group. So if you let me, I can ask a question in there and get a colleague to either have a chat with you, or you go see them or something. But I think it's definitely worth getting a second opinion.
Great stuff. There you go, Tina. Fantastic. Yeah, I mean, you're mentioning the language we use and everything. There's some great examples, but well, if you're listening to the podcast and people are watching live, then put February the 23rd in your diary, because I've got a guest. So it's not next week, it's the week after, who is probably one of the best people to listen from with regards to the words we use and the metaphors and the influence that language can have. I won't say it now, because if I say it, then suddenly I'll get 12 other people ringing him up and saying, oh, can you do a podcast? So that's how it works these days. But no, make sure you guys have got the 23rd booked free. It's gonna be a fantastic episode. I'm really pleased to be on the show. Fantastic. Right, thanks, Tina. Thanks for sharing all that with us. It's really useful and interesting to know about. Catherine Reimer dun 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 has says, if someone has worn orthotics long term, could there be a case of retraining the brain? The brain is remembering the old pain. The brain is remembering, hold on, Yeah. The brain is remembering the old pain, or is the pain, or the pain from weakness, underused tendons, muscles in the area. Do you have to take them through strength work if they do get pain due to a change in how they are now standing, walking, using their feet in a different way?
Yes. So,
nice question, Catherine.
Yeah, it is. The one thing I'll clear up from that, so there's no sort of misconception, there's some people who think, who claim that orthoses, if you wear them all the time, will cause you to get weaker. There's no evidence to really, there's been no repeatable solid studies out there that I'm aware of that have shown that. However, yeah, I think a lot of people's lower limb issues are down related to capacity issues. They're just not strong enough to do the task that they need to do. So working on increasing the strength through them, and then once they're strong enough, the way I explain it to patients is I use the whiteboard, and we'll say that this is the range that you're at now. The aim of the range is to get you even bigger. And what we may do is that, say, if that's your loading level here, you're still operating within that range, but you're wearing your orthoses, may put your load here, so you've got a bigger window to play with. But we may be able to find, we can get you strong enough where you can do all the activities that you want to do without needing to wear the orthoses. The hard part is that every human being is different and everyone responds differently. So I can't reliably predict the outcome on the same person and repeat that on different people. But yeah, I think there is definitely a case of doing strengthening exercises and then looking to remove them. But I wouldn't say that wearing the orthoses long term has then caused the weakness of the muscles in the foot.
Very good question. I think I've seen Craig Payne just erupting various times on people who claim that the orthoses are making you weaker. Yeah. It's interesting. It's really good, Catherine, that you're mentioning the brain, because obviously behind every single orthotic device is an emotional rationalizing brain. But it's interesting because it reminds me of the other day, like I'm teaching online sports therapy, and we were just going through a bit of AMP, and we just did that thing where we were just going through, well, musical toes really, but putting your feet flat on the floor and lifting up your big toe, seeing if you can lift up the big toe and not the other toe. So basically working the hallux extensor and the flexor individually. And even though I was teaching maybe 5-6 people, two of them just couldn't move their big toe. It just wouldn't move by itself. They had to lift the toes with it. So is that a strength issue?
Or is that a...
You know, that's, what I mean,
yeah,
because it's like how do we define strength if they haven't got that neural connection, not being able to flare your nostrils? Is that a strength issue because you're not able to activate that muscle?
Exactly. You get some people with plantar fasciitis can't abduct their toe, and that's not because abductor hallucis doesn't exist. It's just inhibited in some people who have plantar fasciitis. So you can't, the muscle won't go from be massively weak that you can't do it to then suddenly 2 weeks later be able to work, because we know from a physiological viewpoint strength changes don't happen that quickly, and that there are sort of the neural connections and neural pathways, and then there's preconceptions around pain and I can't do this exercise because it's unfearful, it's going to hurt. That's not a strength, that's an educational problem. So it's it's, and this is what I love about working in this sort of therapy world, it's not straightforward. There's no 2 days are the same. I know it sounds really cliche, but it's sort of every day is different, and no two patients are the same. It's this is what I love about our jobs.
So did you say it's not a strength thing then if you can't flare your nostrils?
Well, I don't know. I stop at the hip. So
that's my podiatrist. What do you talk about noses with a podiatrist? Ridiculous. No, great question, Catherine. Really interesting. Yeah, and really nicely answered. I'm not going to go on because I could just go off on that. That's great. Really good, Catherine. I love it. Tina, she has clawed toes. Tina's come back with a little bit more information. She has clawed toes, can drop fingers between all toes, foot splayed. So, yeah, definitely worth sending all this information or contacting Nick. And, there's a lot to be thought about. Please help. Oh, my God, Lisa. Capital letters. We better get in there. Please help. My clients had plantar fasciitis for 12 months now and has been having sports massages, also doing all the stretches given by physio. Just checking there's nothing after stretches. No, just all the stretches given by the physio and orthotics from podiatrist along with electrotherapy, but she is in agony. Nick.
Yeah. So if I was to tell you that plantar fasciitis is one of the most common causes of foot pain, but we still relatively know very little about it and how it works. If you look at the work by Scott Waring, so I personally treat it like a tendon. So, but the only difference is sometimes the plantar fascia enjoys being stretched, whereas, you know, if you've got a tendinopathy, tendons don't like to be enjoy stretched. And there is some work out there by another therapist, Michael Ratliff, I think it was, looking at using strengthening exercises to try and target the plantar fascia and calf region that showed it had a benefit. Now, the issue is we got to be careful because that one study has been then blown up. People have taken that one study as gospel and said everyone must do strengthening exercises for plantar fascia issues. And I think it depends on the age and there's a lot of other things to it. However, for me, I am in the camp of I think strengthening exercises are important for your plantar fascia patients. And it's trying to find out what that recipe works best. And I'm looking up there, sort of, okay, you've had the orthoses, you've done some stretching, things aren't improving. For me, then it's looking at, okay, now the thing that's missing from that, and it could be some strengthening work. And again, it's from the data we see in clinic is that celiac strength. We definitely see a reduction in strength. And we are looking at our data. And because we do the strength testing on our patients anyway, we're going through some plantar plate data at the moment, but Achilles is next and then plantar fascia will be on the list. So we can start to see from 18 months of seeing patients, are there any common patterns that we're seeing in what people present with? Is there continuity of reduction in sleep? Anecdotally, I can say there is, but I couldn't tell you the numbers off the top of my head. But that's what I would be looking at there. And then possibly then looking at activity levels that are being done. Electrotherapy, are you meaning shockwave therapy there, or you just mean someone's like electrocute? Like,
we hope for safeguarding it. Yeah, probably shockwave therapy.
Yeah.
And were you with that, Ab? Interest in a nutshell. It's probably difficult, but something new. Yeah.
Yeah, we use it a lot. Yeah. However, we only use it in so the way we're finding in shockwave, how we use it in clinic is that we'll only do it in combination with a rehab program. And the way I explain what we're finding is shockwave is good at reducing the pain quicker to get someone back to the activities they want to do and allow that pain to reduce so they can get on with their rehab quicker. But I think if we look at our patients a year down the line compared to those that had shockwave that didn't after symptom resolution, there's no difference to where they are. So it's not going to massively improve things a year down the line, but I think it's a great tool to allow you to reduce your symptoms. But I think it has to be combined with then doing your exercises as well, because if you think as a tool to reduce symptoms, that buys you a window then to help get someone loading in. And then it also that helps if you can then reduce the pain, you get better buy-in from the patients, and once they then start doing it, they find the benefit, then they then still want to do more of it. And then when you're talking about plantar fasciitis and orthoses, some patients get on with them, some don't. If you look at the research, there was that BGSM paper. 1 month said orthoses don't work, and then the exact same paper the next month, or it was maybe in the same issue, then said orthoses do work. The issue of orthoses in the research, it goes back to what Simon Spurney and Griffith speak about as the dosage concepts, and it's not well controlled because we can't control it. So when you look at some of the research, someone's had custom foot orthoses, what they mean a lot of the time is they've had a set of orthoses mold as their foot, but everyone else gets the rest of the same prescription. Well, that's not custom. That's just a molded set of foot orthoses. There was one paper that actually detailed the prescription and how it changed. And those ones did do better compared to modified off the shelf. But for me, I'll use a lot of taping, low dye zinc oxide taping. And if they respond well to that, then I know they tend to respond well to foot orthoses. If they don't, then I don't look at foot orthoses. So I almost use the taping as sort of a treatment directive test, as it were.
Fantastic. So much in there. I'm so glad we're recording this. Lisa, so hopefully there's some great information there. Again, it's always worth, like Nick said, look at what a client or patient is doing and try and decipher how much of that is like a symptom modifier, which is going to reduce pain, okay? And how much is actually potentially going to hit the root cause of it. because there's plenty of things we can do which will bring the pain down. But I think that's why things hang around for so long, because we're just bringing the pain down, but we're not actually treating the cause of it. So, I mean, I learned the hard way. I was amazed how slowly I had to progress my strength training, using one of fasciitis fighter and stuff like that. It was so slow. It was so slow. And then you never know whether the lack of strength is because of the plantar fasciitis and to be expected, or whether it's the cause of it. You never know if it's chicken or egg, and whether it's just, who knows.
And is all your strength being inhibited because it hurts so much? So actually, is it not that weak, but actually it's weak because it hurts?
Exactly, yeah. So. It's very tricky. But I just realized how consistency was so important, but much less, because a lot of these things don't hurt until afterwards as well. That's the other thing.
Yeah, and important. I think a lot of it's managing those expectations. So all my patients, they come with plantar fascia tendon problems. I'll often say, look, this could be a 3 to 6 month journey. Mm. So then they know from the get-go that this isn't going to be solved in a couple of weeks. Otherwise, and it's always better to sort of under promise and over deliver. So if you tell them that it's going to get better in 3 to 6 months, but then they get better in a month, they're absolutely amazed. They love it because they got better quicker than you thought. And it's sort of whereas if you tell them they're going to get better in a month, and you're 3 months down the line, it's quite often they'll get disengaged.
So, yeah. Very tricky with a runner or a sports person telling them they're going to have to, change the consistency or even stop. Hopefully not stop, but they have to change their runs for 3 months at least. Tricky.
Yeah, I never try and get a runner to stop running. I always try and get them to do, even if it's a combination of walk running or significantly reduce their running, mm-hmm. I tend to find they're just nicer people to deal with if they're doing some form of running.
Great question, Lisa. I hope that's useful. You can come back, obviously. Chris Kitson, where are we? 58. It's amazing. Chris, question from Chris. Nick, do you feel that there's often a gap between where rehab exercises stop and the activities people are trying to get back to?
Yes and no. Yes. So we see a lot of that, people that end back up in our clinics from where they've had injuries in the past. They've gone through that rehab journey, but then they haven't then been given the most important part of the education on how to try and reduce the risk of happening again. So when we make sure that when we do our rehab package, as it were, our aim is to, we let someone go when they feel they can then manage this themselves and they're back to their level of activity that they want to do. And I'll say to them, the easy part is reducing your symptoms. The hard part is educating you on how to reduce the risk that's happening again. So it's talking about the importance of a maintenance program and why. It's talking about what then they can then do. So if they get a flare up, just go through the process again on your own. You don't need to come back. So you're trying to empower them and trying to educate them to take control of their own health. But it is difficult for patients because trying to convince someone, once your pain is settled, to maintain, carry on doing some exercises 3 times a week. It's difficult. The big thing that we found in clinic that helped change it was when we go through our rehab program, we got a handheld dynamometer and do strength testing before and after, and we'll show them a difference. And some people have an improvement of anything like 200% in strength in the space of sort of 14, 16 weeks. And when they see that and they see the big change and it's their data and they see the improvements, they all then say, okay, I now know why I need to carry on doing this. Or I'll also draw out a graph. So say if your load is here for running 5K, that's where your strength needs to be. But if you want to run 10K, your load is here. So you need to make sure your strength matches what you need to do. So we're very, very big on education, and educating the patient why and making sure it's explained in a way that they understand. That's why the most important bit of physical kit I got in clinic is my whiteboard. I just use a lot of diagrams and drawing for patients just to try and demedicalize everything and just put it in layman terms that they understand.
Great question, Chris. Thank you very much. We're cut off 9:01 now. I'm going to have to scroll through the questions and just see if there's anybody we haven't. Oh, I hate doing this bit because it's getting so late.
With Gemma, I think you've done the most effective way to get her through the pathway. Because quite often in orthopedics, they need to go through podiatry first. even if it's a case of they see the podiatrist, you need surgery, okay, off you go, then it's just following the pathway.
I mean, that's a good point, isn't it? You know, what about, how do you measure, is with strength training, if it's aggravating? We kind of mentioned that with Tim as well, but what stage do you tell them to expect a little bit of aggravation? Do you have a patient who expects no pain?
Yeah, I will tell all my patients that this isn't going to be a pain-free journey. And it's because something is pain, pain doesn't mean it's causing tissue damage. And then I'll often talk about Karen Sibernagel's work, her work around about, okay, it's based on Achilles, that if you anything below a 4 out of 10 on a 0 to 10 VA scale, is that's acceptable pain levels. So that's what we get our patients to work to. So if you go out for a run and it's a 3 out of 10 and it's still a 3 out of 10 the morning after, I'm happy. If it's a 3 out of 10 while you're doing the exercises, then I'm happy. I'm happy with that. As a whole, I don't tend to find strengthening exercises aggravate things. Possibly, yes, you run the risk of pushing too much, and maybe if you get someone who hasn't squatted before or deadlifted and you get them, they may end up with some DOMS. But there's an educating someone the difference between DOMS and an injury. And it sounds silly, but I almost want my patients to go through that period of where they do push themselves too much and flare things up slightly, because then they learn how much they can push themselves. Because for me, every patient starts their rehab journey at a different point, because it depends on what they can or can't tolerate. So as a rule of thumb, I would say we do give few stretching exercises out, but it's mainly strength-based. I'm a believer that if you're, say, doing a heavy deadlift and you're doing it right, you're going to get some hamstring flexibility work built into that while lifting big, heavy weights at the same time. So I know for me personally, what improved my ankle dorsiflexion the most was just upping how much I was squatting. For me, it's being comfortable with patients being in a small amount of pain, but then educating people that pain isn't always bad. We have this connotation that pain is horrendous and it's always going to be causing damage, when that's not the case. I've got x-rays of patients. I'm sure everyone else here will have x-rays of patients or no patients that will come in, and they come in with bilateral knee x-rays, and they look at it. One's got like grade 4 OA and no joint margin, no joint space at all. The other one looks normal on x-ray. And then you're sat there thinking, oh, it's going to be this leg that hurts. But then when they come in, it's the other knee. That leg doesn't give them any issues and they're still marathon running. So that's the analogy of treat the patient, not the scan. But with the strengthening exercises, it's getting people comfortable and explaining a bit of pain is normal. And that also I find helps a lot of people, because if they're a runner or they're doing any activity, a lot of time they stop when they feel any niggle. And if you tell them it's okay, the relief on their face of, oh my God, I can go out and I can still do some running. It's like you just give them a winning lottery ticket. But the big but is you've got to watch out for those patients. You give them an inch and they take a mile. And the beauty of things is that there's so many ways people track their activity levels. And if need be, I will get them just to map it out. And actually, I spoke to Tim and I got his permission that I actually put his chronic workload ratio calculator built into my website. So I get all my patients, when they're looking at what they're doing, is, okay, look, I know there are some concerns around the acute chronic workload ratio, and it's not perfect, but I think overall it's not a bad tool. So I often will, when my patients are planning to suddenly change their activity levels, I'll say, well, map out what you want to do. Put it in the acute chronic workload ratio. Are you getting a number bigger than 1.2? If not, just tweak it and see what you can get it to do that. If you're then coming out of a number that's 1.8, 1.9, then that's definitely a sign that, I'm not saying you're guaranteed to get injured or create more pain, but the odds aren't in your favor. And it depends if you want to play an odds game or not. So,
excellent. That's talking of your website. Let's bring that up, because we're getting close to the time now. How's the podcast going? I forgot to mention that.
Podcast is going well.
Yeah, episode 8, 7, 8, 9, something like that.
I'm recording the next one Saturday or Sunday. I can't remember what day this week I'm recording it. But no, that's going well.
Fantastic.
It's always strange when you realize people download and listen to a podcast and you think, actually, who's actually listening to this? Like, but we still get comments from patients and people message about it. So people are.
Oh, definitely. It's still, I always say at the end of the shows, I'm thrilled that kind of 40, 50 people join us live here. It's fantastic because people are so used to listening to the catch up or something. So yeah, massive. Your website has got loads of information on it. If people want more information about you, are they going to get a lot from there? You've got a blog going on there. What else can they expect to find on your website?
There's a blog, there's podcasts on there. But if you need anything, just people want to message me, just drop me an email or find us or message me on Facebook. And that if you want to get a hold of me personally, that's the easiest way. You can message us through the website, but that goes to my admin team, doesn't go to me directly. But yeah, there's lots of blogs, lots of myth busting on there. The podcast is aimed at, we've got going through conceptions around forefoot pain, heel pain, chats with local shoe shops around about the myths around footwear, and chats with previous patients, so they explaining their journey from injury back to activity and the process we take people through.
Definitely. I mean, the first seven on there, if you could look at the website and have a look at what the first seven podcasts of content is, you'll have enough listening now for the next, depends how much you listen to it. There's a lot of good information there. And there's been some great questions in here as well. I'm so sorry we haven't got round to answering questions. Some really good stuff. Becky's Carol's has some great questions going in there. Some questions from Verona Green. So I'm sorry, guys, we haven't managed to do it. Nick, would you be able to come back sometime, do you think?
Maybe? Yeah, you know me. I'm more than happy. Come back whenever you want.
It's amazing. There's so much. I can't wait till people get to listen to this. I want to listen back to myself. There's loads of information there. I always ask this, but it's a bit weird because of COVID and that. But what have you got? Anything planned to look forward to in the next few months? Or is it all very dependent on?
Very much dependent on what COVID is doing. We got a new staff member starting actually on next 1st of March. We just converted another room. So we converted another room to make a second gym on site and a third treatment room.
So again, one of the things I admire about you and your setup is very multidisciplinary. So what in your team, who have you got now?
So at the moment, we've got myself, one other podiatrist, admin staff, and we did have a sports exercise rehabilitator, but she left to go work in the military. So I have replaced her with a graduate sports rehabilitator.
Fantastic.
So yeah, we put an advert out for physio sports therapists or graduate sports rehabilitators, and we ended up just interviewing sports therapists and graduate sports rehabilitators in the end.
There you go.
So, did you like that?
Great shout out to sports therapists. Okay, mate. Well, look, it's been really a pleasure listening to you. There's so much in there. I knew I would, but I hope you guys enjoyed it. Next week, I'm getting a bit organized now. We know who's coming up next week. So next week, I have the pleasure of bringing you Jack March, who is going to be doing a rheumatology 101. It wasn't supposed to be another Ask the Expert, but it'll be more than that. It'll be about the often kind of cloudy and unknown area of rheumatology with regards to sports, people you're seeing. Again, the same lines and what to look out for, red flags and things, to work with physios with regards to that. All out of our area because we're not really taught it, but important to be looking out for these things. Often slips through our fingers when we don't know what to look out for. So that's next week, next Tuesday, with Jack March, who, if you don't know, is a really lovely bloke and a great character, and really excited about that. And then, like I say, February the 23rd, which is the week after, put that in the diary. Definitely really excited about bringing you that. I'm just not going to announce it yet. Keep you waiting. Nick, thank you so much. And thank you, everybody, for joining us. We'll be back next Tuesday.
Can I just pick up one more thing before we go?
Of course you can. Anything for you.
Becky, Carol, I was just sifting through the comments. I may have to do another little separate video of me just recording, answering some of these comments and just send it to you. I think it's Becky, Carol, in response to Matt's comment,
I went to
a podiatrist when I was in my early 20s because of bilateral knee pain. I was told by the podiatrist they wouldn't be able to comment on my knee pain because podiatrists don't look at feet in relation to pain higher up the kinetic chain. I was told I overpronated, I walked out never to return. That's mostly the best thing he did, walking out.
Yeah, but Becky's only 23, so it was 3 years ago.
It's So to me, I think podiatrists are anatomy training and our core training goes up to the hip. I'm not saying we are hip and knee specialists, but we need to have an understanding how that kinetic chain works. And overpronation, I'm not a big fan of that, but I won't go into why. But no, I think if you're going to see a true musculoskeletal podiatrist, they should be able to comment on the knee and have a look at it at the same time in relation to the foot problem. They may feel not comfortable diagnosing the knee pain, but they should understand the relationships between the foot and the knee, how one can affect another.
There you go. Becky's very clued up. She was condemning that. She was just basically, she hasn't got closure on what happened to her and she just needs to shout about it a little bit more. She's very clued up, our Becky. Great stuff, people. Right, we need to go. 9:12. Thanks so much.
Nice.
Thanks again to Nick. And we'll see you next Tuesday. Take care.
You're listening to the Sports Therapy Association podcast. Let's talk about it.